Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Craig Hamilton of CitizenCraig.com. Ben Stark of Wondermill Films.
Good morning, Craig.
Hey, good morning.
So, we found out this week that you had never seen Die Hard before. You watched it last weekend, is that correct?
That's right, and I'll have to tell you, or remind you, that I did not tell you guys I had not seen Die Hard until after I'd actually seen it.
Right.
Yes.
Which is probably, I don't know, maybe a good idea, because we would have all, you know, harassed you until you actually saw it, because it's, for me particularly, it's a seminal movie, and I feel like a very important one. Is that a feeling you got after you watched it? You know, separating it from all the things you've heard about it over the years?
Yeah, you know, that it's kind of, you know, these days I usually watch movies in pieces, and I was able to watch it in, you know, the span of a few hours, which wasn't bad, but, well, actually, you know, most of one day, I guess, but, you know, I was able to separate it from all that, all the, you know, pop culture, what have yous, and I've done that before with other movies that aren't nearly as popular, and I found that I'm able to do that, and I'm, you know, and it's enjoyable. Like, I think I saw the first Terminator, like, you know, years ago, but it was, like, way too long after I'd probably... I really enjoyed it. Because in any of those movies that were, like, way back in the day that used kind of, like, older effects or more practical effects, it's kind of like... I like that stuff anyways, and so I'm able to... Especially when Terminator 2's got such, you know... They spent more money on effects, obviously, but that's a big contrast there. But yeah, I was able to do that with Die Hard. I was able to, as far as like making this movie or guessing how they made this movie, it seems like it's like two categories, like one external outside that building, and then two, or maybe even three different ones. Just the Christmas party of the group standing around, and then Bruce Willis kind of just filming Bruce Willis, a bloodied and half clothed, you know, hiding or lurking around elevator shafts and stuff.
Yeah. He is so separated from everybody else in that movie. I mean, everybody else has people to bounce off of or interact with. It's like the cops outside and then the party goers with his wife. Those are the three perspectives. And then or four really terrorists, and then John McClane. But yeah, it's fun. That's one of my favorite things about the movie is how those perspectives interweave and interact. But it all goes to isolate him all the more. And at the end, you realize it's something that it's so subtle. They don't call a lot of attention to it, but you realize that. Him and his wife, although we've met them and spent time with them over the course of the movie, this is the first time they've seen each other in, you know, maybe months after they've gone through all this stuff and had no clue where the other was.
And they were able to reconcile their marriage through this ordeal.
Have you seen the other movies?
Because she iterates her last name is different than his
throughout
the movie. And then at the end, she clearly states, no, it is McClane.
Absolutely. Yeah, don't watch the other movies. it is a great little arc there of reconciling that. And I think it came at an interesting time for gender politics. Obviously, that's kind of one of the big subtexts of the movie is everybody is shocked that she's kind of the in a power position in the company. And, you know, he's one of several males that have trouble dealing with that. And I think that's, in a strange way, kind of progressive for 1988. It doesn't necessarily, you know, it doesn't become to the forefront of the text or anything like that. It's just kind of in there.
Right.
So what stood out to you the biggest out of what's like the one or two biggest things you took away from the movie?
It's probably gonna be right now at least. It's gonna be these things that I probably would have taken away that are just small little details that stick in my head, kind of like when you watch E.T. for the first time and all you remember for the rest of your life mainly is Reese's Pieces and Han Solo action figures and a dinosaur head. But here, what really struck me right off the bat is kind of the really fiery background early on in the movie. It's so unreal.
Yep.
It's surreal. It's just like, no way. There's no way that sunset looks like that. And then with the oriental kind of design of her office, or what, maybe it was just like a really crazy 80s look that was kind of inspired by that style or something, but it was just like a really stylistic kind of thing there, that because the rest of the movie is fluorescent lighting or nighttime. So
It also speaks so well to that moment of its time where Japanese culture was taking over, especially electronics, but then, you know, a lot of corporate America, a lot of venture capitalism, was coming from Japan for these big companies. There's this kind of like this Japanese pastiche on the interior because it's a Japanese company, but then once you get to the guts of the building, it's totally, you know,
right,
American kind of construction, metal beams and everything like that. And one thing that struck me a few years ago is that it's a strange working out of World War II in a way, you know, where you have the Japanese and the Germans and the Americans kind of reconciling and kind of getting into this like little scuffle, this territorial scuffle. I don't know if that was an intentional thing or just kind of how the casting worked out, because I think in Germany the terrorists are not portrayed as German. I forget. I think there's a story that they're Irish maybe or something like that. The production design and the cinematography are two things that really stand out to me. Of course, the cinematography is Jan de Bont, who would go on to direct great movies like Speed, and then he would also direct other movies like Tomb Raider. And he just does amazing work in here. He worked with Paul Verhoeven before this, so he has that iconic, in my opinion, 80s, early 90s camera work where it's also controlled, it's also clean, and yet it's the camera movement is natural and motivated, but the lighting is slightly expressionistic, and that's also something that the director John McTiernan brought in, I think, because if you look at his first movie, Nomads, with Pierce Brosnan, it's lit in such a expressionistic and strange way, and here you have a little bit of that brought in, and where lighting is naturalistic it's coming from, you know, believable sources, but there is this slightly surreal quality, like that, you know, California sunset out her window. And I feel like that it says so much, you know, it's like a foreshadowing that there's going to be red, you know, that there's going to be blood.
Mm-hmm.
It tells you that, guess what, we're going to nighttime. And then also I feel like it puts McClane in this otherworldly state. You know, it's this guy that is from New York where it's cooler and colder and the sun doesn't shine as bright, maybe, and yet here he's kind of against the hot red backdrop, and that's he's out of his element there. I think it does a lot, and it's one of my favorite things about the movie. It's just that overall design and the cinematography.
Yeah, I completely agree. It definitely screams. It reminded me of Vietnam in a way, just from those, other movies I've seen like that.
Yeah, Apocalypse Now with the red sun, yeah.
Yeah, it's about to get crazy as far as, you know, gunshots go and explosions and stuff. But one thing I also took away is with McClane, the McClane character, you can't really tell by his facial expressions if the cards are stacked against him or if he has, like, an ace up his sleeve, you know, like, for instance, the whole thing at the end where, like, you know, he wasn't sure, not at the end, with the gun taped to his back, but also when he let Alan Rickman's character get that gun with no bullet in it, and we weren't really sure. I was trying to look at his face. I was like, is he worried, or is he like, I'm about to show this guy? You can't really tell.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of got this, a little bit of a poker face, but I think his cockiness would scream to a good face reader, this guy's got something else going on that we don't know about.
Yeah, that's something that, even now, when I watch the movie, it gets me, how, I'm like, is he falling for this right now? Is he getting worked? It's like, man, that's really stupid. Did I forget something that I hated about this movie, or that
yeah.
a big problem? And then it's like, oh yeah, no, he's playing.
Right, right.
But yeah,
it would be stupid if he fell for it. It would be it would be against his character if he actually did fall.
Right,
for that,
because Rickman's American accent is one of the great things about the movie, but it's also the least convincing American accent I've ever heard in my entire life.
Oh God.
Yeah. Definitely McClain is. He's kind of like Batman in a way, in some ways, where he's very much not like Batman in most ways, but in some ways he is, because he is one step ahead of the audience a little bit. You know, the hierarchy of knowledge is sometimes weighed towards what the terrorists know rather than what they know, or then sometimes what Al and the outside knows. I could see that, but there is a humanity, I think, that early Bruce Willis brings to this role that. It's just so refreshing, you know, for this kind of an action movie. And really what set it apart is this guy that, you know, was just not prepared for this at all, both emotionally and mentally and physically. You know, he's just so vulnerable, and that reads on his face, even when he's projecting kind of, you know, typical macho manhood. This guy is not, you know, matter what he might tell you, he's got cracks.
And he's talking to him, so he's kind of hard on himself, or I think there's some kind of decision he makes that he wishes he hadn't early on. And also his radio dialogue with the cop on the outside.
Reginald Bell Johnson, Uncle Carl.
Yes, the father from Family Matters.
Uncle Carl.
Or the limo driver from Crocodile Dundee. Carl Winslow. But
Carl Winslow, there you go.
That's got some really, really cheesy dialogue when he calls him, how you doing in there, cowboy? But it's perfect, though. It's like
that's
belongs there.
Yeah. And you get the feeling that, I mean, that's kind of Al's part, is that he does kind of wear his heart on his sleeve a little bit more. You know, he's buying stuff for his pregnant wife. You know, he isn't the most... traditional image of manhood. You know, he's a little bit more emotional, and that's what keeps him from being the principal from what's that actor's name? Paul, the principal from The Breakfast Club. I should have the IMDb. The guy that comes in and thinks he's the cowboy. And it's there's so many characters in this movie that, you know, they feel like their masculinity has to come first, you know, and they come in with so much swagger, and they all
like the coke addict that tries to make the deal.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Booby. I'm your white knight. Ellis. Guy directed the movie UHF, I believe.
Interesting. But that's
PCU,
the one thing.
Maybe PCU. I have one of those comedies with an acronym. Go ahead.
He introduces coke into the movie, and which reminded me that I would have never survived corporate America in the late 80s.
Because you would have done too much coke.
What happens? Do people work?
I think they do better.
Do they murder people and then they stay up all night and I'm talking from American Psycho to
I think they do a lot and then they make a lot of big decisions with a lot of reckless intent, and sometimes they strike gold, sometimes those work out, and then 30 years they become president.
That's the exception to the rule.
We'll see. Going forward. Ellis 2020.
As long as we're going forward, then maybe we're good. I don't know. It's wishful. I try to keep hope, but I try not to go into wishful thinking. But yes. Yes, but so what else? Oh, but Carl Winslow, he had a reason for being a little more emotional because of his backstory
he killed Urkel.
There's so many things that are current right now. So like if you made a movie about an office shooting right now, that could be misconstrued as being in bad taste. I'm not even saying
misconstrued. There's a movie out right now. I think I forget what it's called. It's produced by James Gunn or written by James Gunn or something. But yeah, it's basically about a hostage situation at an office building, and it turns into a horror thing. And yeah, I remember talking to somebody, and they're saying like, "Oh, that's kind of in bad taste." It's like, well, it's kind of like Die Hard a little bit.
Yeah. I was like, well, this is a mixture of things that we're dealing with right now.
Yeah.
Mass shootings and terrorist attacks.
And school and youth being shot by police officers.
Exactly.
And it's a reversal. But yeah, absolutely. If they made Die Hard today, that would be a huge hot topic if they cast a black police officer that accidentally killed a teenager. Or they could, make it a hotter topic and reverse that and have a white officer in that role, and that would be interesting or troubling, or it could be all sorts of things depending on how they handled it. But but that's crazy. Is that it does tackle so many of those things, but kind of like True Lies, which is cogent and in ways that none of us like. It's still so fun, And at the end of the day, these terrorists aren't religious extremists, and they don't necessarily want to murder everybody. They just want money, they're just thieves. And I think, I feel like that is one of the touches that McTiernan brings to it, where he, in a lot of his films, there's such serious setup, but he brings a lightness of touch, and then there's often a reversal. I think of Basic has that element without spoiling that movie, or, The 13th Warrior, which is this big monster movie, but really it's just the barbarians. And even Die Hard with a Vengeance has a similar kind of twist. There's a playfulness to the whole movie, and I think it goes to also the fact that it takes place at Christmas time, and the Beethoven Ode to Joy-based score of the movie, is so playful, and it feels like an opera at times more than this gritty, realistic action movie.
There's some good underlying sort of foundations of the movie, or maybe not foundations, just elements of the movie, backdrop settings that kind of contrast what's going on. Having something like that at Christmas is always a interesting way to do that, because you're kind of crapping on Christmas, man. And so that's a little unsettling, so it makes for a more interesting, maybe a more tense film.
Right. Yeah. It raises the stakes in its own way. So as a big Harry Potter fan, it's interesting to me that what was your first introduction to Alan Rickman? And because I feel like I would have looked at Snape differently if he hadn't been kind of the villain of my childhood, which is how he functioned. Did you see Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves when you were a kid?
I did.
Okay, all right.
But
so
you know,
he was already sniveling evil to you.
Right. Oh, yeah, but when I saw the first Harry Potter movie, that impression, him and Harry Potter immediately overshadowed everything else he had done that I had seen. So, yeah.
Yeah, see, that's for me. For me, this is it for him. This is the defining role. And even Robin Hood is colored by... I mean, clearly, went from that to this, and quickly down under too. He's just this awful, awful guy.
I can see more of a connection between this and Snape, because here, No, he's not always in control, but he does. He delivers. His delivery is very similar to some of the things mm-hmm. he does in the Harry Potter series. But
yeah, arrogant, very arrogant.
Yeah,
yeah, he's great. Are there any other? I mean, I think Willis brings a this kind of Harrison Ford-esque down to earth charm to this role that he rarely has recaptured since then. But aside from Willis and Rickman, any other performances stand out to you?
No, not a ton. The one terrorist that you knew was going to come down to like a little showdown between the two because he goes his way.
I forget his name. Yeah,
but he's just doing his job. I don't think it was an outstanding performance, but it was kind of like that's the evil. That's one of the bad guys that you'll probably remember forever, probably.
Well, I remember him because I was a huge fan of The Money Pit when I was a kid, and he plays like the smarmy Euro trash boyfriend that's up against Tom Hanks in that movie. So he's I always conflated those two when I was a kid. I was like, those could be the same character. You know, he just had a bad day and ended up becoming a terrorist.
You know, a fun little cutaway here and there is that kid in the limo driver.
Oh yeah. Yep.
That could easily be like, get this out of here. You could easily cut that whole, you couldn't easily cut the whole thing because he saves the day. No, you know, spoiler in a way. But yeah, you get the lights blinking like a disco and he's like drinking with a stuffed animal.
It's funny that he's like having a great time and like, it's like, man, that would be like without an iPhone. Like, what would you do?
Oh,
like, if you couldn't like get on Twitter, you would just be drinking champagne in this limo. Argyle, that's his name. That just occurred to me.
But if you think about that type of technology that he had,
sure, he did have
at his disposal.
Mm-hmm.
To us, would be like probably have like a limo with like computers and TVs.
Yeah, yeah.
So we might be like, you know what? Screw it. I'm just staying here. I'm not going to drive anywhere.
Yeah,
but absolutely. I'd probably be like, I might go home for a little bit.
Well, it's LA.
It's LA. It's like you can't go anywhere for a little bit.
There's one issue that I have for this movie, and we kind of got into it there, and it's something that I don't know if I'll ever be able to reconcile, and I'd like to get other people's input on this if it bothers anybody else. Neither of us may be the right people to speak to it, but there's an element where, there's Theo, who is the terrorist kind of like computer guy who is, young and black. And, at the end, he's basically taken out by Argyle, who's young and black. And it's kind of like that weird thing where in comics, they always pit the women versus the women and they kind of put the types together and it's like two, they're not. I wouldn't say there's neither character is a stereotype. Like I feel like both are pretty well fleshed out characters, but it's still kind of weird that they got pitted against one another as if they're like, well, they got it. You know, they got a fight at the end. That's one that I think that might be the only thing with my heart that I'm just like, ooh, that's an 88 decision by old white John McTiernan thought would be neat, but actually comes off as a little bit insensitive and troubling in some ways.
So here we are, almost 30 years later. We're in 2017, listener. But I don't know that, because I pick up on stuff like that too, all the time. And I think about it in my head, and I kind of mull over it for a little bit, and of course I try to torturously say, what would I do, or how would I handle that, or what decision would I make? Oh, that's just never going to happen, but it's just what I put myself through. And I don't know that do we notice these things 10 years ago, 20 years ago? Did anyone notice it 30 years ago? Was it even I don't think it was a deal back then.
I think it was a conscious decision in this point. I don't think it was an accident.
Right. I agree.
But
I don't
think it was a decision made. I don't think it was a decision made with malice. I think it was a decision made like trying to, ingratiate himself towards that culture.
I agree it was a conscious decision without question. But is it something people watch and it kind of bugs them in 1988 or in 1998? Do people see that and go, horrible, but I wouldn't have done that?
I would assume that culturally there may be some African American viewers that viewed that and were like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
You noticed it in 1988, and now that we've all become a little bit more in great ways, more conscious of cultures other than our own. I think now we're more sensitive to that. So I mean, but whether or not it's a good or bad thing, I think it's on a scale, and I think it's a thing. It's up to the person.
Thing, and it's like, why? What, it's sort of like, I mean, it's not like the worst thing, but it's like a thing. It's like, okay, but why?
If you
roll the dice and say who kills who, like, that probably wouldn't have ended up that way. So why did you make that decision? I would love a commentary, and like a non-judgmental commentary or a Q&A where they just honestly explain their thought process behind it without judgment from anyone, because again it's a little bothersome when you see it and think about it for a little bit, but it's not like, you know, it's not like some whatever. But
if an African American person told me they were offended by that, I would say, okay, like, that's I understand, and that's fair. You know, I'm not going to argue with anybody over if that offends them. But at the same time, I think you're right. Like, I don't think there's necessarily a reason for John Tiernan to be super defensive about that. But I'm with you. Right. I'd love to kind of get in his head in 1988 and see, like, okay, well, like, what took you down this narrative road?
Yeah, to get here. Because listen, I think I'd be a little pissed. I think if that were me, doing that and. But who knows? You never know how, you know, things. You never know how it comes across. But I could definitely see how that would be offensive to some people even back then. But
I'm also a big fan of, like, let's contextualize for the period and understand where culture and where people were at the time but to a point, I'm not gonna wave the flag for Birth of a Nation or anything like that.
Right.
The first one.
Yeah, and who would have known this conversation would have gone this direction? But, I agree. Yeah. You cannot judge the past through your own current lens straight up. You have to – there's so many different things, and even talking about a scene from 1988 where a good black guy kills a bad black guy and everybody else is white. I don't know if I see that 20 years ago and think, even sort of think about it. I'm sure I would, but how would I think about it? Now, I saw it and I was kind of like, huh.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's I don't know, for me, I don't know if it's worth a full-blown, you know, expose, but at the same time, I feel like it's notable enough to bring up, and it is one of those things that every time I watch it, I'm like, that's a conversation I always love to have with people about Die Hard. It's like, where are you? What are you? Is this a thing? Or is this? Are you know?
It's got to be, because the bad guy was just working on computers the whole time.
Yeah.
And he just busts out in a car. I guess it makes sense that he didn't die. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe it's worth pointing out that there neither one is a negative stereotype, which is good. Like I said, I mean, you know, you've got this in 1888, especially, it could have been much worse. You've got Theo is this super highly educated computer engineer, and Argyle is this lovable, well spoken, thoughtful young guy. So it's like, in terms of like racial stereotypes, I don't think there's anything there. It's just, it's just the pairing. It's just a pairing. It's just funny. But yeah, we have talked about this probably more than two white guys should.
Does he accidentally kill him though? Does Argyle
he backs up the car and it kind of ends up killing him. Yeah. So it's not like, it's not like a fight, you know. It's not like he steps out and there's like a Sergio Leone standoff. It's just like it happens to go that way. But.
And not that this was a part of the thought process at all, because I don't know that it would have been. But did they not want to have one of did not want to have McClane kill him?
Yeah, I don't think he's worth it in terms of like the damage that he does. I feel like that.
Sure. Yeah. No, that makes sense because and McClane is basically the only good guy, and he's white, yeah. So it's not like they didn't want to have a white guy killing him.
Well, there you go. That may be another thing is that they saved the image of Bruce Willis shooting this black youth, and that kind of didn't directly kill anybody, you know. So that would have been really unsettling in many ways.
He's also Tyler from Matlock, I think.
Oh. Interesting. Okay. You schooled me there.
He's the assistant. He's Matlock's assistant in some like half of the episodes.
Incredible.
I think that's right around the time he would have been working in other stuff too, probably. But.
All right. Well, pending fine.
No, that's an interesting point. I would be interested to talk to you offline in possibly having an episode of many other instances like this that happen where we see today and we're kind of like, there's something inside me that's kind of saying, hey, that's weird, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
We can talk about that.
I think there's several filmmakers where we're like, we've kind of accepted it. It's the Woody Allen, Woody Allen, Coen Brothers thing, where it's like, there aren't very many black people in their movies. And when there are, they're Marlon Wayans, you know, in Lady Killers, where it's like, I don't know about that. I feel like when it comes to like culturally troubling things like that, we kind of need better representatives than the film nerds who are all white dudes from Alabama in their 30s. You know, we are limited in our perspectives.
Indeed, so.
But anyway, we're having a production meeting on this recording. But going back to Die Hard, it's great, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, what do you give it? Does it live up to the hype? Is it a 5 out of 5 or whatever?
Mine are out of 4. It's definitely
right.
A strong 3.5. And I wanted to watch it more because I need to watch it again because
yeah, you do.
It's one of those where you want to watch it again after you've seen it for the first time. But
strong,
it's 3.5, 4. It's definitely one of those too, and probably will just get better with time as it does with everybody else. And
yeah,
the hype
doesn't
bother me. Like, you know, I was a big Friends fan of the different TV show, and there's an episode where they just want to rent Die Hard all the time and watch it over and over and over. And I hear all this stuff about Die Hard, this, Die Hard, that. And, like, that expectation really didn't bother me because the people that talk about it, Die Hard, like that, enjoy watching it because it's an enjoyable experience, and they're not saying it's Citizen Kane, you know, which nobody ever wants to watch Citizen Kane over and over and over again. But so I don't think I was particularly hindered by the hype for my expectations, at least.
Well, good. It's in the same conversation as Citizen Kane for me.
As personal faves, for sure.
Yeah, and just in I mean, but for me, there's no difference between personal favorites and best movies of all time. Because
if only my taste
is all that matters.
If only Ebert had done a commentary on Die Hard, then...
Oh, my God. He definitely reviewed it favorably and liked it when it came out. But, yeah, I mean, I feel like somebody needs to do one. Somebody needs to do a frame-by-frame dissection of Die Hard.
Okay, well, I've been thinking about... Yeah, do it. I've been thinking about what other commentaries I'm going to do next.
Dude, I can't.
We
like,
should
I
do
don't
a,
have time to watch any movies, let alone do full-on commentaries for them.
You got to wait till everybody's out of town.
Yeah. All right,
so
well, let me start cooking up a reason to get my wife and child out of the house, and then and then I'll talk. Well, all right, man. Well, I'm glad you like this movie.
Okay.
So have you seen any of the other ones? Like, incidentally?
No.
Oh, interesting. So here's what you should do. You should watch Die Hard 2 just because you need to get to Die Hard 3. And then quit.
But watch Die Hard 3 and then quit?
Yeah. Watch Die Hard 2 because it's not because necessarily it's great, but it is good. But because you need to get that to get to Die Hard with a Vengeance, which is great,
And then never, then you don't really have to watch any more Die Hard movies. I mean, I'm a fan of Live Free or Die Hard, but at the same time, I'm not going to argue that it is on the same level as these.
At what point do I go to the Fast and Furious franchise? After 3? Or
well, I would say
watch the first two now.
Watch Die Hard, then watch Point Break, just as a lead up, and then watch Die Hard 2, Die Hard with a Vengeance, watch Sudden Impact starring Jean-Claude Van Damme, hop into Tokyo Drift, but just the first 15 minutes where you get to meet Han, then watch Fast 5, and then go from there.
So Die Hard 2, then Cross Point Blank,
And then Striking Distance, because Striking Distance is actually it's John McClane using a pseudonym in that movie.
And then Out Cold. And then it up with Out Cold.
Out Cold is it's kind of like the epilogue to all of them. I've got a spreadsheet. I'll send it to you.
Okay. Awesome.
Okay. Well, that's a pretty great way to wrap it up, man. So I'll just cut it right there.
All right. Yippee-ki-yay. That would have been the better one to wrap it up.
For Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.